Hey guys, if you know me, you know I love to travel and you know I love to save money. This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further. Literally. They cover all things travel finance, like how to plan group trips that don't bust your budget or your friendships. How to maximize points for real savings, not just free bottled water. How to avoid paying for upgrades you won't use, and so much more. They're doing great work over there. Check it out. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. The winners are the people with the most stories.
One of the great things about traveling is the people that you meet.
I've slept in bus stations, I've slept on people's floors.
And it's already on fire, and then there's just a gigantic, huge explosion, like out of a Hollywood movie.
It's not right or wrong, it's just different.
We hired 10 Chinese prostitutes to come be our audience.
We were kidnapped by nuns in Puerto Rico.
Not a good idea to be high when you're packing. You forget a lot of stuff.
I got swine flu.
By the time you've lived through it, it's just a good story.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Siegel. Thanks for listening. My guest today is Kenny Dunn. And before we get to Kenny, let me tell you about our website, traveltalespodcast.com. Go there and you'll see stories that I've written, stories that some of the guests have written. You'll see photos of me and the guests. You'll see the guests' social media. You'll see our social media. Travel Tales Podcast on Instagram. That's where we are. That's the one, the numbers we want to build up. Follow us on Facebook. Give us a thumbs up and a like and a follow on whatever streaming service that you use to listen to us. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever. Do that. Give us a thumbs up, a star rating. Say some nice things. I'd appreciate it. If you want to write me, maybe you think you're right for the show. Maybe you know somebody who'd be a great guest. Or you want to ask me anything or tell me I'm awesome. You can write me at traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. That's traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. Kenny Dunn seems like someone who has a great gig. I'm very jealous of his gig. He's Eating Europe. That's the name of his site, Eating Europe. You want to take a food tour around some of the best cities in all of Europe? Who doesn't? If you listen to this show, you know I love to eat. And I have quite often eaten and, well, drank my way through Europe. And I'm always looking for someone who knows that local vibe. Take me to the places I wouldn't find on my own. Let me try something I can't get back home. That's where experts like Kenny come in very handy. He's a Philly native, and I actually met him through Jessica Parker, who was on the show earlier this year. The Trip Whisperer. She and Kenny are fellow Philadelphians. And like a lot of people, Kenny came out of school, got a job in New York City like you do, and then realized, yes, New York's a big city, but the world is even bigger. And he wanted to see it. And he took off around the world, spent about 4 years on the road, came back to the U.S., met his future wife, who ended up getting a job in Rome. They settled in Rome. And of course, when you're living in a place like that, your friends come to visit. Often. He ended up leading him around the city, showing them his favorite places, and decided he had a knack for it. And he started his own company leading food tours around Rome, and then it just grew. You can go to eatingeurope.com, get recommendations, book a tour. They are in cities all over Europe, from Amsterdam down to Lisbon to Prague, you name it. He still lives in Rome, so he was nice enough to stay up late and do this interview. But I am jealous of him living that Rome life. So check out eatingeurope.com and listen right here to the man who started it all. Here's my chat with Kenny Dunn. Kenny Dunn, you're in Rome, and I'm jealous because I always love going to Rome, and I always love Italy, and you're sitting there, although it's late at night, so I appreciate you staying up late to do this.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thanks, Mike.
How long have you lived over there?
So I've been here since 2009. So
wow. Okay.
Yeah, it's been a while. Never dreamt that one day I'd be living in Rome, as incredible of a place as it is. It just, as life happens, I found myself here. I thought I'd be here for a year, and it's been about 16.
So. Wow.
It's been a good run.
Well, we'll start it from the beginning. Where are you from originally, and what was your travel background before you ended up in Rome?
So originally from Philadelphia, So the opposite coast is you.
Is that how we both know Jessica? You're a Philly person as well?
Yeah. Yeah.
We're the trip both whisperer. Philly people.
Exactly.
Okay.
I was just listening to your conversation with her.
Yeah, she's great.
She is great. Yeah. So Jessica and I are both Philly people. I actually had a pretty extensive, so grew up in Philly, kind of stayed in that area, went to Penn State, moved to New York City, kind of a similar path to a lot of people over there, and then decided, all right, the world's much bigger than this little pocket. And that's when I set off for, similar to this, what was supposed to be a 1 year around the world thing that ended up being a 4 year kind of around the world thing with stops in certain places. So that was, I don't know, maybe that ended about 2 years before I moved here. So I was already kind of used to living abroad, being a traveler slash expat.
Right.
But this is the longest I've been abroad in one place.
So were you working in New York City during 9/11? And was that kind of, we're actually talking on 9/11.
Yeah.
Ironically.
I was just gonna say. Yeah.
But was that a catalyst for you to, like, you know what, maybe taking a few years off is not so bad around the world?
You know, I was living there in Greenwich Village.
Oh, my God.
I used to walk out my apartment, which was right off of 6th Ave. And 6th Ave was like a straight shot to the Twin Towers. You could stand kind of anywhere on it and see them. And so that was crazy, you know, the next day and, you know, all the days since to no longer have a view of the Twin Towers. So I was there and, you know, being in downtown, you know, really got, you know, was really there in it, experiencing the fumes and everything for months and months, and just the, you know, the whole situation of being in the city. I was going to say, like, the mood and the solidarity and everything. But no, to your question, it wasn't at all a catalyst for me wanting to go abroad. I mean, you know, I was just starting to get a little itchy. I think a lot of us travelers or people who travel, someone kind of inspired you along the way. So for me, I had two cousins, a brother and sister. And I think the brother who's older, you know, he inspired his sister. And both of them had traveled all over India, all over Asia, Latin America. And because I lived in New York, it was often like a stopping ground. So they'd come in and be like, oh, my God, you should hear about this place in Laos. I'm like, what's it called? Laos, like right on the river. And we were swimming every day. And these were like long, not like
right.
a 10-day vacation. They were traveling, you know, for months. And I would just hear these stories. And they each probably passed through four times or something in these. And I'm like, you know what? I can't just stay here. So, you know, eventually I had my own business. I sold my, with two partners, two of my friends from middle school, I sold out to them and then literally bought an around the world ticket. They used to sell those. I don't know if they still do.
I remember those. And, you had to go the same way though. You had to go the same direction, right?
Yeah. Yeah. There were like a couple of restrictions, but considering it was some serious bang for your buck, like, it was like $1,000 and you could do like 9 different flights. And I didn't get such great value. I actually just flew to New Zealand, stayed there for like 11 months and 28 days. And then as my visa and ticket were expiring, I took the second flight to Australia. But so I got
Australia. That's as far as you went?
Yeah. So, I mean, I had because I don't know if
you could have swam to Australia.
I know. I'm not that good of a swimmer. The way those tickets worked, you actually had to like plan your itinerary and book all the flights.
So you locked yourself in a way.
Yeah. I mean, you had to, so I had a beautiful itinerary. I mean, it was going to be New Zealand, Australia, India. I don't know if I was flying to Nepal or overland, then to Singapore. And then I think I was actually making it to Latin America. I mean, it was all laid out. And I literally just did LA to
New Zealand
to Auckland and then Auckland to Sydney. And that was it. So they did pretty well on me as a customer. Yeah.
What waylaid you in New Zealand and what was her name?
Very good guess. And normally about 96% of the time you'd be right. But this is this time, you know, I spent like maybe the first few months traveling around, and then I landed, you know, I went down. So starting on North Island, went down to the South and found myself in this little town called Golden Bay. Well, the town is called Takaka, but their little area is called Golden Bay, which sounds pretty idyllic. And it absolutely was kind of this hippie little enclave right on the top of the South Island that they say gets more sunshine than anywhere else in New Zealand. So amazing weather. You've got like seals swimming right off the coast. And I was doing this program called WOFing, Willing Workers on Organic Farms. It's an acronym. And basically you put like 4 hours, some is working on farms or in kind of community gardens or even in someone's house, and they put you up. So kind of early pre, like kind of couch surfing with a twist, you know.
Right.
And I ended up working at these community gardens and met this great group of people. They then needed someone to do fundraising. And I'm like, well, I kind of did a little of that back in the States. So they gave me a trailer, like, you know, a stationary trailer on the, and these are like, my hair's down to like, you know, past my shoulders. I've got a huge beard. I'm like in full hippie mode. And, was like, I met this great group of people and I'm like, why did I set out to travel? To meet good people, learn new things. I was learning all about like farming and growing food. And I just didn't want to leave. So I just kept pushing back the visa. And you only, as an American back then, maybe it's still, you only have a year. And so right at the end of that year, I was like, all right, well, got to say goodbye. So that's kind of what happened.
And how long did you stay in Australia after that?
And Australia was 6 months. So again, all of this was supposed to be 1 year. So now I've got my parents, you know, when are you coming back? And you need to get back to your life and da, da, da. So I spent 6 months in Australia again, kind of, you know, and for me, like a big part of those travels, you know, I was 28 and was, you know, I was doing, I did like a 10-day silent meditation retreat. I did other kind of retreats. A lot of these WOFing things were like staying in these alternative, like hippie
communes. Like a commune or like a kibbutz.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no kibbutzim, just because it was, I didn't get make it to Israel, but
right.
I mean, like one of the,
you know, you had a
yeah, similar thing, maybe a bit more alternative. One of them, like, was right on the beach in Australia, and pretty much like 70% of the people are walking around naked. You know, great place for waves. I've never seen so many people surfing naked. I don't think I'd ever seen anyone surfing naked before that. And like, can I borrow your board? And some guy just struts up, you know, nothing on, like,
yeah,
here you go. I'm like, all right, let me just hop right on the one you were paddling out on. Yeah. Nothing weird about this.
Want to borrow my suit? You
know, yeah, exactly. But I,
this sounds amazing.
I was just throwing myself into everything.
Sure.
And so I was less concerned about seeing sights and stuff and more just meeting new people. I did a lot of hitchhiking in New Zealand, which led to all kinds of crazy adventures, and Australia too. And then my plan was to sail, to hitch a ride, speaking of hitchhiking, on a sailboat to Indonesia. And I was with a friend at that time. We put up signs everywhere, anyone looking for crew, which apparently is a thing. We came close, but in the end, nobody wanted us as their crew. So I actually had to fly to Indonesia, and then I spent a few months there.
Oh, you were in Bali?
Started in Bali, but then made it all the way east to East Timor, which at the time was the newest country in the world. I don't think it still is. But I was just going – the further east you go, the less – of anyone from the Western world you're going to see. So I was on some pretty remote islands in the east part of Indonesia.
That sounds incredible. So before we get to Indonesia, let me give me one of the craziest hitchhiking stories.
Okay. One of my craziest hitchhiking stories So I'm in the East Cape. It's on the North Island, really interesting, cool, beautiful area of New Zealand. And I'm out there for a while. And, you know, as a guy, I mean, I did pretty well getting picked up, but sometimes there were long stretches. And I remember just going, oh, come on, someone, please. It's been like 2 hours. So eventually some guy picks me up and, you know, where are you going? Wherever, just heading north. And so at some point he's like, look, this is me. You're welcome to crash at our place. I was like, all right. I mean, I had nowhere to be, no schedule, anything. And we had just been talking for like an hour. So I end up crashing at their place. And it's him and some other guys. He's a bouncer at a bar, and I'll get to that in a quick second. And then, you know, these guys, I mean, they're not even getting high, but they're doing some other stuff. And I'm like, next thing I know, I'm in their house. I'm like, where am I? Completely freaking out, like questioning every bit of judgment I might have. I was picked up as a hitchhiker. I'm in this house, now out of my mind, having done something, like in the bathroom, like, I can't believe I'm here. You know, I didn't have a cell phone, by the way, like in general.
Right.
Anyway, kind of got my senses, end up going to his bar, having a great time, like where he was a bouncer, crash at their place. The next day they wake me up. They're like, you want to come out? We have a bunch of lobster traps. We're going to go out in the morning and pick them up. And so we go out on their boat, picking up lobster traps. Next thing I know, it's like the next day we're eating lobsters on the beach. It's like, how much better does this get? So it ended up being quite an adventure.
I got to be honest with you. I did not see the day going that way when you started that story.
I didn't see lobsters on the beach in my future that way either. The East Cape is known as being a pretty rough and tough area.
Oh, wow.
These guys looked the part. You know, he was a bouncer with tattoos everywhere. So there was a few moments where I was like, you are the dumbest person ever. But it all ended well, and I've got a good story.
That's great. What was the business you were in that you sold?
So right out of college, myself and, again, two of my closest friends from when we were in middle school, we started this event marketing company where we'd go to college campuses and kind of set up different promotions for, you know, anything from like phone cards to working with some banks. At that time, it was like the explosion of the .com, as we called it back then.
Oh, yeah. I remember it well.
Every website. Yeah. You lived through it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was like, sign up for collegeclub.com. So we would be out there handing out like College Club, which was one of many websites that came and went, t-shirts, if you kind of gave your name and email address. And then they could say, you know, we've got 10,000 members. And then we eventually started selling posters too. But so, yeah, we did. That was my first traveling just in the U.S. In those 2 years, right out of college, we bought my friend's parents' van, and I think I went to like 42 states, you know, always college campuses. But that was like one giant road trip with my two best friends. So that was, and then eventually, yeah, I was like, all right, I think it's time for me to do something else. And that's when I bought that ticket.
Right. That's when that's how I spent the 90s, was traveling around college campuses doing comedy. So that's, I saw a lot of the country that way. I got to tell you, some of these schools I had never heard of, and I didn't know where they were. It was little tiny campuses in the middle of nowhere. And you were like, okay, I guess this is the deal, but I never would have heard of it otherwise.
And doing clubs or like on campus? Like
performing on campus. Because, when you're starting out, it's a big thing because it pays better than clubs. I mean, you got to do an hour, but you have to have an hour and you're alone. Yeah, yeah. And sometimes you're in the cafeteria, you know, it was horrible. But it was a great way to see the country, I got to tell you.
And then for years, like me, people can say any school and it's like, oh, yeah, right there in right outside Birmingham. Yeah, I've been there. Like, you've been there? Like, it's 900 people. Like, yeah, I remember it well. You've got that subway. It's right next to the, you know, yep. like,
Yeah, I know. It's really amazing. So this next trip, so Australia, New Zealand, and this turns into 4 years. You go to East Timor.
And that was like a month.
Wow. Well, I mean, that sounds, I mean, is that, I know nothing about East Timor. I've never talked, I've done this for years and never talked to anybody who went there. What is
Finally.
It like?
That was my goal for this podcast, to bring up some country
that no one's ever been. It's not exactly on the backpacker trail, you know.
No, it's not. Unfortunately, it's a very nice place. So first off, it's part of, so half the island is part of Indonesia, and then half the island is its own country, East Timor. So Timor is the island.
Okay.
You know, what's interesting, so that was 2005, and I think it became a country maybe in 2003. All this should be fact-checked, but that's my memory. And, you know, there were still UN kind of jeeps and stuff driving around, because there was a conflict that eventually, I think, led to a resolution. So it was interesting for me, because I'd never been anywhere that you know, that you had this kind of UN security presence, and it felt very much like, even though I wasn't in the press, like, wow, I saw people with the press jackets and stuff. I mean, as a country, you know, like I said, it's just the other half of this island, which was very similar to like the prior two islands I had been to, maybe a little more mountainous. So it wasn't, the most dramatic or kind of unique thing was the political situation. But yeah, some nice beaches. You know, I remember, going to the beach, seeing, you know, some of these remote islands, you meet these travelers who are traveling, you know, on a sailboat. So I remember this one couple, I think from Australia, who was docked right off the beach, you know, anchored, not docked. And, you know, meeting them but other than that, like very, very few tourists. I mean, anyone I met was there in some capacity as part of the kind of the peace or kind of starting up of this new country in some diplomatic fashion. But the islands further west, they were, you know, some of them had the most kind of pristine, untouched beaches. Every town you'd go to would be like, hey, mister, like, because it was so shocking that someone was there. And, really interesting experience, even just making it to East Timor.
No, that sounds amazing. So we've gone this far without even talking about eating Europe and how you came upon this. And how did you end up in Europe? And when did you decide, you know, a website for it and eating? And did you have a culinary background? Were you just someone who likes to eat? How does all this happen?
Right. I mean, one of the things I love the most when I was traveling, especially in some of these kind of developing countries, was going to the local markets, because, you know, they were just so interesting. I mean, besides the foods you might have a chance to eat, just seeing these crate jackfruit, if you've never seen that for the first time, seeing a jackfruit, like, that's a fruit. It's like,
yeah, it's a crazy looking
size of a watermelon.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really crazy looking. And smelly foods like
durian.
Durian, I was just going to say, you know. And just seeing the people, you know, you can engage. And so that was always like one of my number one things when I go to these different towns. So all of that's to say, like, travel and kind of food and traveling for food and eating street food, that was always like just a big part of what I loved most. So fast forward. So after Asia, I moved to, I was traveling in Latin America and ended up living in Colombia for a year, working for an NGO, and decided, you know what, I want to do this like for real. So I applied to grad school in DC in international development. So that's what I was going to do and work for, you know, in humanitarian aid. And it was there that I met who would become my wife. She was in the same program. And when she graduated, she got a job here in Rome for the UN here. The Food and Agriculture Organization. There's a few UN agencies in Rome. Nobody outside of that world really seems to know that, but it's actually, there's like 5,000 UN employees right here in the center of Rome. And so we went there, like I said, at the top for, we went here, sorry, for a year. That was what her contract duration was. And it was like, all right, we had just gotten married. It was like, let's try it. I got a job at a different UN agency. Then my contract ended. She got promoted. And it was like, okay, what am I going to do? And what the biggest thing here in Rome, other than politics, is tourism. So I was starting to think, what can I do around tourism? And the thing that I love doing most with all the people who visit you, and you get a lot of visitors, especially in those early years, is taking them around my neighborhood, showing them where I go for my cappuccino, taking them to the market. And I used to love and still do going to the market and do all my shopping, even though we have supermarkets here. And introducing them to the like four or five different kind of vendors that were my guys. And people would say, that was so much fun. Like, that was just as good as going to the Colosseum. And then it kind of evolved into like, you should do this. And I love telling stories and kind of love taking people around, even though they were mostly my friends or friends of friends. And then it kind of, I had heard at that point, I had heard of food tours in New York. And I was like, well, why doesn't this exist here? And kind of just started connecting the dots. Again, I'm unemployed, so I'm spending time researching it. And I just eventually put together kind of a script, a route, a website, and a TripAdvisor listing. And I was open for business.
So you were doing walking tours, or you would lead groups, or would this be every day?
Yeah, walking tours. Well, at first it wasn't, I mean, every book, anytime I got a booking, I was leading a tour. The max, and it still is today, was 12 people. So that could be six couples, or it could be a family of six and, you know, one single traveler and seven. So in the early days, it was mostly just two people who, by the end of like the 4-hour walk, were like my best friends. I knew their whole life story. They knew mine, in addition to all the other info and content and anecdotes about living and eating in Rome. But, you know, then as it started to pick up some momentum, it'd be like, well, today I've got four couples. And within 6 months, I was doing tours pretty much 6 days a week. Sundays at that time, I didn't offer them because the market was closed. But so it was like every day, taking people on the same route and eating the same three pastas, because I would eat the pasta. Right.
Yeah, so. That can get dangerous, though. Wow. So yeah. What do you think was the best way that grew your business? Was it, say, like TripAdvisor, or was it like Instagram, or like social media, or word of mouth, or what was the catalyst?
Yeah, I mean, in the early days, it was all about TripAdvisor. And especially if you build a website, and this is true today, you know, it takes time for, you know, Google to kind of index it and all of that. But there, if you were on TripAdvisor and you got good reviews, and it used to be much more simplified then, like there was one list of things to do. Now there's 17,000 categories and you show up. But then it was one list and everyone knew, because I knew a lot of other people doing all kinds of stuff. You know, food tours, cooking classes, Segway tours, bike tours. And we all knew who that top 20 was. And everyone was trying to get in that top 20 because that was page one, unlike Google, which is 10 listings. And if you got on that top page one, if you were in that top 20, like you didn't need anything else. You know, that was kind of such an incredible funnel. In the meantime, you know, the website was getting built up and we were getting traffic. So if you Googled where to eat pizza in Rome, we were trying to rank for that and stuff like that. But in those early days, it was like, thank goodness for TripAdvisor, because that's how we got everyone pretty much.
So when you're leading these trips, what year did that start?
So started in 2011.
2011.
So 14 years ago.
Okay. Wow. All right. And were most of your, I guess, customers or
Were they mostly American, or were you getting people from all over?
We were and still do get people from all over. But, you know, the lion's share of the people right. to this day are, but, you know, got a lot of Australians and those guys, like anytime, you know, in the morning I'd look like, oh, who do I have? And I'd love getting Americans. And because I traveled so much with everyone, I'd go, oh, yeah, you're from wherever, Rochester. Yeah. I was there. But Australians just have a different energy, like in general, and are so much fun. And so it was great, you know, to get them and kind of, and also it was great to have a mix. You know, sometimes I would have people from three or four different countries and see how they interact and kind of connect. It was always nice to see people connect to a very different backgrounds. You know?
So what's the name of that market? Because last time I was in Rome, I went to that covered market that has all these food stalls in it, and it's pretty well known. We had to take a cab there.
It might be that one, the Testaccio Market.
Maybe that's it. I think that's it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a few covered ones, so I wouldn't say for sure that's it, but that's definitely one of maybe the three best.
Loved it.
Covered market. Yeah, it's great. It's great. And when I started in year one, that one hadn't been built. Like they moved to that one in 2012. And the other one was 100 years old and falling apart, but it had so much character. I used to love going there. But yeah, that this one's a bit more modern and, you know, but yeah, they're both great.
Uh-huh.
The whole experience.
So when people come to Rome or anywhere in Italy, you try to steer them in a certain direction because, like, you know, past, we want to have pizza, you know, you gotta like, it's like, no, this is a local thing. You can only get here or.
Yeah. Well, you mean in general or on the tours?
In the tours, but I mean.
Yeah. So on the tours, like every tour and not just in it. So we operate in 20 cities across Europe.
Well, we'll get to that a little later.
Yeah. But just to say, the reason why I brought that up is just to say in each place, kind of the recipe, if you will, is to try and kind of take people to places they wouldn't otherwise find on their own. So even if you came and said like, yeah, I definitely want to have Roman style pizza. Of course you do. We want to take you to a place that A is like really authentic and good, but all and has a story. And also kind of gives you the feeling that like, oh man, like, I don't think I would have found this place if I didn't do this tour. Like that's what we're trying to kind of that, you know, accomplish or at least leave people feeling like, wow, part of the value was discovering things and places and learning things. But in terms of what, you know, it's a mix of trying to give like a really good version of what we know you're going to eat anyway. So you can hopefully say, yeah, the best piece of pizza or croissant.
Or gelato.
Paris. Gelato I had on this tour. And then it also is trying to introduce things that you probably wouldn't. Like in Florence, we let people try lamprodotto, which is the fish stomach. It's kind of in the, like tripe. You know, it's part of the inside of the stomach. And you know, when you hear it, it sounds gross, but the way it's prepared with this green sauce on this beautiful bun, you know, we really encourage everyone to try it who wants to. And, you know, 90 some percent of the time, I'd say like 98% of the time, people are like, oh my God, that is really good. And it ends up being one of the favorite things they do. So it's kind of a mix of the classic expected stuff, but hopefully like a really good version with the story behind why that is so classic and more adventurous new thing.
What's a very Italian dish that you would think we can get here in America, but we really can't, or it's super hard to find and it shouldn't be. And that you think should be part of American. Right. It should be everywhere because you love it so much.
Yeah. Well, one thing I really love a lot are the Jewish style artichokes. These are, so here in Rome, I mean, some things are limited because, you know, like it could be a vegetable in this case that you just don't really see that variety. So this is this Roman style globe artichoke. They're massive, like the size of a softball.
Yeah.
And what they do, they peel off the outer leaves and peel down the stem. So it's much thinner than kind of how it is, you know, kind of the stalk, if you will. And then they fry it once, then kind of it sits in, you know, in a dish. And then when you order it, they fry it again in olive oil in the pan. Ooh. It's not like deep fried. And, you know, just salt and pepper. And it's, you eat the whole thing, including the stem. It's crunchy. It's delicious. And like, that's something that I don't think I've ever seen in the States.
I want to eat that right now. That's a good, you described that really good.
Thank you. I mean, there are things like cacio e pepe, amata di chana, carbonara, which like cacio e pepe, I didn't see that when I first moved. I didn't see that in America in the first years I was living here. And now you see that. I'm sure there's a half a dozen places in LA that you know.
We know a couple because why? Because we got hooked on it in Rome. You know, it's because it's amazing. But
it really is. Simple, amazing. I think the biggest thing, one more thing I was just going to say is like the simplicity of dishes here. Like what I miss more than like a singular dish is just more places kind of understanding that at its core, that's what Italian food really is. And in the States, not that you can't get great Italian food, especially in cities like New York and LA and San Francisco and Chicago that have historic Italian populations. But generally it's like, this is chicken and shrimp and it's got, you know, like whole tomatoes, cherry tomatoes. And, you know, and sometimes we'll throw calamari in there too or whatever. And it's like, this dish would never exist because it's just got too much going on. And that's kind of what's wrong with it is it's like, it should only just have a couple ingredients. And, and that's something that I miss when I'm back in the States, you know,
so many, kind of simple. So many chefs talk about that. It's like, where do you eat when you're not working? And most of them go to like you said, very simple things. They said, if the ingredients are good and fresh, you don't need a lot of extra stuff on it. You don't need to cover everything in sauces and crazy, you know, whatever reductions and things. It could just be as simple as a grilled cheese, you know, but if it's done well, you know what I mean?
There's a great Stanley Tucci movie, Big Night.
Yo, that one's awesome.
And he kind of gets at that where like they were preparing it the real way. And in this kind of South Jersey beach town, they all wanted the more like kind of Olive Garden style. And that movie, that's it right there. Like, you know, seafood risotto just has a couple pieces of seafood.
So good. When did you branch out into other outside of Rome and then eventually into other countries and other cities? When did it start growing?
3 years in. It was about 3 years in where we started branching out to Florence. And then actually it was only Rome and Florence in Italy for years and years. We went to London, and I say we because, you know, it started just as me, as like I was doing everything as I described. But very quickly I said, you know, I need someone doing marketing. I need who like really knows what they're doing and someone to help me manage things. So it very much was like a collaborative effort, even though a lot of people have come and gone from the beginning. I've always had a great team. And so then London and Prague and Amsterdam, I was at like 8 cities until COVID with ambitions to do more. And then COVID happened and then kind of pulled it back, closed the city, hung on for dear life. And then over the last, 3 years, we've actually grown from that 8 to 20. So now we're kind of really on a more of a growth trajectory in terms of destinations.
Well, I mean, I can't imagine it's you going around to every one of these cities and eating and finding all these places. Do you, or maybe it is, but do you work with?
It's me.
It's you?
I'm on the road eating about 319 days.
Good Lord.
No, it's not. I mean,
I was going to say, you got to have like people in these cities who really know.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, just to unpack that a little, like, in the beginning, I would go to every city and help set up every tour. Kind of, I was coming with, this is what we're trying to do here. But I was never the one, other than Rome, actually kind of selecting the places. So our kind of formula has been find someone local, tell that, you know, like do a whole recruitment, find someone who kind of really gets what we're trying to do, understands the kind of experiences we're trying to create, and then say, all right, this is kind of what we're looking for. Then they kind of put it together. And in the up until a few years ago, I was always the one who would come in, let's walk through what you created. And sometimes it was like, this is it, you nailed it. And a lot of times it was like, I love that stop and that stop. This one doesn't really feel authentic enough, or it's too small, or it's too long of a walk, or it's too repetitive, or whatever. There's so many variables. And then together we would kind of like take their, let's say, rough design and try and make it more of a polished final product. But in every city, we have at least one local, what we call operations manager. And they're the ones who have, these are their places. It's their neighborhood, you know, and that's what we're kind of taking advantage of and showcasing.
Are they all walking tours? I mean, or is some of like, we got a van, everybody pile in the van and we go around?
So we haven't gotten into any vans or
a bus,
but with that said, in Amsterdam, and I actually just did this tour last weekend. We do have one tour that it starts on foot, then we hop on one of these beautiful saloon boats that goes through the canal. While we're on the boat, we swing over, and someone hands us a bunch of these. I don't know, have you ever had something in Amsterdam called bitterballen? They're like these fried balls.
Okay.
And it's a fried ball filled with like a meat kind of, like a meat ragout, like a, almost like a meat ragu, but not that saucy.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then kind of breaded and deep fried. And it's like the most popular beer
snack. Street snack. Yeah, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And so, you know, they hand them into the boat. We stop somewhere else and they'll hand us a platter of cheese. So that one is kind of both. And then in Rome, we've got one tour where at least we move around in a golf cart. and those are, you know, for people who
don't walk, you know, or can't walk.
Yeah. Can't walk or have mobility issues. Plus it allows us to cover a lot more ground. That's always one of the limitations. There could be like the best gelateria here and the best pizza place over there. And like, there's no way to cover that on foot. So, you know, with the golf cart, you know, you can actually kind of string together places you couldn't. And then also in Lisbon, it's similar to a golf cart. They call them tuk-tuks.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So we do a tour where you can ride around in the tuk-tuk.
That's fun. Do you make a conscious effort of saying, okay, the tours have to be, say, under 4 hours? So, I mean, do you have like a specific time limit you put on these?
Yeah. I mean, all of our tours are around kind of 3.5, 3 to 4. We're now starting to experiment with some shorter ones, as that seems to be kind of where the market's moving. So we want to kind of have something that fits everyone's kind of preference and availability. But, you know, our kind of sweet spot forever since that very first tour that I started has always been around 4 hours.
Okay. Is there
a half day?
Is there a price point that's consistent in most countries, or does it vary greatly from city to city?
No, there's not too much variance. I mean, in most cities, we have a daytime tour and an evening tour. Those evening tours generally have
alcohol,
you know, cocktails, and drinks,
yeah,
alcohol.
There we go.
Also known as alcohol.
Yeah. Okay.
So that bumps up the price. Also, like dinner, you know, if we're taking a table somewhere and it's dinner for that restaurant tour, you know, he or she's going to want to charge more. So, so ballpark, you know, and everything's priced in euros or pounds in the UK, but, you know, to convert it, it's about, you know, a daytime tour is about 75. Euros, which these days the conversion rate's been changing.
85 US or something?
85 to 90.
Yeah.
And an evening tour would be like another 25.
Okay.
Possibly 30 years on top of that.
So you mentioned Amsterdam before, and people think of Amsterdam. I love Amsterdam, but people think of it. They don't really think food. And God love the Dutch, but they're not it's kind of a running gag, their cuisine amongst a lot of people. So what is the, aside from these fried dough balls, what are the...
More like meatballs, just in fried meatballs.
Fried meatballs, sorry. Yeah. What are the other things? Like, I don't know what the Dutch, other than fries, I don't know what are the big Dutch specialties.
Yeah. So, and it's very fresh, like I said, because I was just there, about 5 days ago. So, the Dutch are famous for their apple pie.
Okay. There you go.
So a lot of this is like both what you're eating and where you're eating it. So the place we go to is from 1650 something. I mean, it is so historic. And this apple pie is just delicious. I'll give you one testimonial. There's a signed letter on the wall from former President Bill Clinton, who was there in Amsterdam. Someone must have recommended go to Cafe Pop Island, and he tried the apple pie and loved it so much that he had to send them a letter and tell them just how amazing it is.
That's cool.
That's on the wall. And that's probably when he was more of a big eater. So
yeah,
that's,
high now praise. He's all vegan. That's great. Okay,
so there's these little, they're famous for their big pancakes, but also there's these little ones, which are kind of puffy. I don't know what they look like. Smaller than a silver dollar. And those are called pofertjes. Mm-hmm. And they're like airy, delicious. Something a lot of people don't know is that, the Dutch were very big colonists. Colonial Dutch Empire expanded to
Africa,
Africa, India. I mean, Indonesia America. Was a Dutch colony. So there's tons of America, New York. I mean, so there's tons of Indonesian restaurants, and that's
great.
A big part of the cuisine. Indonesian, and also Surinamese, which is a small country in South America. And so we visit. We try some Surinamese or Indonesian food. And that's something that for most Americans, they haven't had because for whatever reason, especially Indonesian, that really hasn't taken hold, unlike, let's say, Thai or Vietnamese. Yeah. That's something else. I mentioned the bitterballen. And trying some of the cheeses. I mean, the Dutch really do have some wonderful cheeses. Gouda cheese, what else?
Meats, cured meats.
We do some cured meats. We do a little of that. There's something which it's kind of a very much a comfort food called stumpot. So it's basically boiled things in a pot that are mashed up, and so it's kind of like a potato mash with carrots and then they, sometimes there's sausage mixed in, or the Dutch have this very particular, very delicious kind of meatball. They're these huge baseball sized meatballs. So they might throw that in there. That's really good. The interesting thing is like Amsterdam and Prague, of course, doing a food tour in Rome or Paris is like kind of a no-brainer, but it's also just as interesting to go, and maybe more so, to Prague. Like, what do you eat here, Amsterdam? Yeah. Like you said, and then if we can put some food in your mouth, we're like, wow, this is really good. The payoff is almost better than having really good pastries in Paris, which you were kind of much expecting.
Yeah, sure. Is there like a different kind of tour where you do like say an all vegetarian or that kind of thing for any kind of diet?
Well, we accommodate. I mean, not every tour accommodates every dietary.
Yeah, that's impossible.
Restriction, but we try to have at least one tour where it's like gluten, intolerance, this, that. So to answer your question, no, we don't have a vegan tour, a vegetarian tour. But if you are vegan or vegetarian, we will substitute out, you know, so that stump pole, you're not going to get a meatball on top. You know, we'll put something else or, you know, whatever it may be, you know, you'll have the cacio pepe and someone else might have the carbonara, you know.
So if this is a question I always ask of like travel writers and reviewers and guidebook writers, it seems to be easy to kind of guide business toward your friends and that kind of thing. And of course, they want the business. So they might be willing to, you know, sweeten the deal for you a little bit. How do you fight that? And you want to help a good vendor, but you also don't want to, you know, play favorites, I guess. I mean,
right.
Or get bribed.
This is kind of, kind of peeling back the curtain. But no, with every place we go to, I mean, we are, you know, paying for the food. So basically there's a place that we think is great. Oh my God, this place has the best custard tarts in Lisbon. And now we want to say, look, we're going to be coming here sometimes 5 times a day or more. We want to bring our groups. You know, are you willing to work with us? You know, and I mean, custard tarts are probably not the, let's say it was getting a table somewhere.
Yeah.
They're not just going to give us a table. I mean, we try and negotiate like, all right, we don't want a full, you know, fried artichoke, let's say. We just want half and we want some burrata. And so we might customize something. All right, okay, for that, you know, it's going to cost you X. And so it's not like, I mean, they may be giving us some kind of discount because we're essentially buying in bulk. You know, we're a wholesale customer. But at the end of the day, you know, we're a patron of that business and we really look at them as partners. I mean, if someone asked me for a recommendation, like if you told me, hey, I'm going to Venice next week, I mean, there's probably a good chance I might send you to one of our places because partly why we chose to work with them is we think they're great, you know, the food they make, the story and everything. But it's not kind of like, you know, if you did a tour in Morocco and they're like, and we're just going to pop into this carpet shop.
Yeah,
you know,
I've had that.
You can see that like that wasn't even part of the tour and they're getting some kind of kickback as you're like, when can we get back on the bus if it's one of those guys?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of those kind of setups. And so this is very different. You know, we're choosing these places. Sometimes you're like, nope, we don't want to work with groups. You know, so it's not like, and, you know, and have a very kind of, a relationship where they're giving our customers X, we're paying them a fair price. And then hopefully our customers like, wow, that was an amazing taste. Can we book here for dinner tonight? And they're coming back. And so they're getting even more value out of our relationship, you know.
Well, one more question about the tours, and then we'll get to you personally. How about the craziest story with a guest? It's like something happened. Maybe they had an allergic reaction to something. Did they choke on a whatever? Or
nothing?
Okay,
nothing
good.
Bad has ever happened on any.
How about
tours?
The most difficult?
I will say we did. I mean, this just popped into my head. It's tough to know if this was the most or something. But I remember early in the first years when I was still guiding, we had a couple. They were engaged. And on the tour, you know, they called off the engagement.
Oh,
I don't know what was happening. And I'd like to think it wasn't, had nothing to do with the food they were trying or our guide. But literally, it was like a group of 12 people. And they are bickering the whole time. You would think, you know, you're in Rome. It's a pretty romantic place.
Yeah.
And at some point it was like, this is over. And he storms off. And you can imagine the awkwardness in the group when that happened. And, you know, she's trying to – he stormed out and, you know, trying to kind of, you know, like, no, carry on. And so that was kind of awkward. But – on the opposite side of that, But the flip side is that we have had a proposal, I think more than one, on the tour. So, you know, someone's been on the tour and said, this is where I want to pop the question. And she said yes. And so that was, and we had champagne waiting because they tipped us off ahead of time. But yeah, so that was something that that popped into my head as a very memorable.
That's a good one.
Memorable experience, yeah.
I interviewed a, I don't know if you know, Nomadic Matt, the traveler. He had this rule, I think it was a 4 or 5 block rule, that you know, you never eat like 5 blocks from a tourist attraction, or 5 blocks, you know, within a tourist attraction. Do you have a rule of thumb like that? Is it usually a mistake that tourists make, that they eat someplace too close to?
Yeah, I mean, generally, if you're, I mean, I think kind of the most convenient place,
is
you come
good,
out of the
yeah.
Vatican, you're starving, is probably not that good.
Like Rick Steves and would always say, the good places wouldn't have a guy out front calling you in.
Yeah.
And other, mean, those, yeah.
Yeah.
And other places, they say, you know, if there's an English menu, don't eat there. You know, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, pictures on the menu. I've never been to like a real authentic place in any country, certainly not in Italy, that has pictures on the menu.
Right.
So, I mean, because if you're Italian, you don't need
exactly.
visual.
We know what it looks like.
To know what you're ordering. You know, I mean, even things like, obviously things like a crowd is a good one. You know, and the turnover. I mean, I also feel like, I mean, this is kind of maybe, it's essentially what Matt's saying, but just maybe more extreme. Like, I love, like, if you stay in an Airbnb and you're in a neighborhood where there's not even really hotels because they didn't build any there because there aren't any attractions, and can find the place around there, then you know, like, even if it's not the greatest food, it's definitely an authentic experience because that's a neighborhood, and it doesn't even have to be so far out. It's just a place where there's no hotels and no attractions. So any restaurants are catering to the local residents. So I like doing that. You know, I like staying in Airbnbs that are kind of more residential and trying to find places like kind of in those little spots, in those neighborhoods.
What about street food? You got thoughts on a cart? You got, you know, the guy standing behind a cart. Some people have the thing. It's like, I got to see them make it. You don't want anything that's been sitting out in the sun too long.
I think, you know, especially if you're traveling like in summer or, you know, in hot places near the equator, like, yeah, you don't want to be eating that in midday and when it's baking under the heat. I mean, if it's a kind of contained trip of a week, I'd say get more adventurous kind of towards the end. I mean, because if you eat something bad on like day two, it just kind of ruins the whole trip. Yeah. So ease into it. Let your stomach get used to some of that, you know, local bacteria and stuff. But yeah, for sure. I mean, especially with something like street food, you want to make sure there's a lot of turnover. You want to hear it sizzling. I mean, always better to eat something that's cooked and hot and you can see it and hear it being cooked. I think those are good rules to live by. But, you know, when I was traveling all those years, I got sick so many times.
What was your worst one? Where was your worst one?
Probably in Bolivia. I don't know what I was thinking. Again, going to this market in Sucre was the name of the city. And, you know, had like, oh, these fresh fruit smoothies look good.
Oh, no.
You know, like, and with, you know, probably with water, ice, and that just knocked me out for days and days. And the worst thing is sometimes when it does, it like your body doesn't, you know, that bacteria or whatever, it takes you a while to get right. You know, that could be, you could be kind of not quite right for like a month or two.
Oh, yeah. I've interviewed people that some people got knocked out for months long after they got home. It was, it was rough. I've been all over Italy, not all over, but a lot of it. But I have been to Bologna, and they love to say how the food in Italy is all great, but it's the best in Bologna. What are your thoughts on that, being now a Roman, and maybe you're a little biased?
Yeah. No, I mean, I would agree. I mean,
oh, you would?
I don't know if I'd say, well, here's what I would say. I wouldn't necessarily declare that as, you know, the number one cuisine in Italy. I mean, there's 20 regions, each very proud with their own local cuisine and signature dishes. The thing with Bologna is, you know, the classic, what outside of Italy, people would say bolognese sauce, which isn't, you know, it's ragu is what it's called locally. But like that kind of tomato based meat sauce is such a signature, iconic part of the Italian kind of kitchen. And that's from that region, you know, so like lasagna is from Emilia Romagna, which is that same region. And, you know, Parmigiano, like Parmesan cheese, well, Parmigiano
from Parma,
Reggiano cheese is from that region. So is, you know, prosciutto di Parma. So is aged balsamic. So a lot of these things that are some of the most famous, iconic tortellini are all from there. So I think that kind of gives them a pretty good case for some of the most famous Italian foods in the world come from their region. But some other places have incredible foods that most people aren't so familiar with just because they're lesser known regions.
You know, it's very different. I mean, I went to a wedding in Sicily a long time ago, and there were some people sitting next to me who were from northern, you know, Italy. And I asked them the name of what this dish was called. And they're like, oh, we don't know. We don't eat that. Yeah. And we're like, wow.
That's amazing. That's what I love. I mean, because some people think, oh, that's
Italian.
It's all the same. But no, like, and, you know, Italians, just like us, travel. You know, if we're going to Chicago in the States, you're excited to try deep dish. Just like when they come down to Rome. As much as an American would, it's like, oh, we're going to get a real amatriciana, you know? And so people travel around looking for those dishes, even if it might exist now, it's spread out more, but it's the authentic version. You have to travel to the place where it's from.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody came to visit me and they asked me where the good grits are, I'd be like, you're asking the wrong dude. You got to head south for that, my friend.
Yeah. You don't get good grits in LA.
No, you really don't. I'm from Chicago originally, but I lived in New York as well. So, eating is, it's the history of a place on a plate. You know, why do they eat this? Where did it come from? And you keep peeling the layers of a place's history.
Although,
you know?
It's funny. So many have the same story, which is like, this was, you know, just the, this was made out of necessity.
It grew around here. We had to eat it.
We had to eat it. It was kind of the, like in Italy, we say Rome, the cucina povera, like the poor man's kitchen. But so many kind of local dishes started as just kind of, you know, a poor person's dish made out of necessity, and it's grown and grown, and now it's something very different. But often they have the same origin story. You know?
So now about you living in Rome, you've been there since 2009, you said?
Yeah.
It's a long time. I mean, you were talking like 16 years now. So how good with the language were you when you went there? How good are you now? How long did it take? And...
So not good at all when I got here. Much better now. I mean, I speak Italian still with like a horrible American accent. The thing that's so frustrating for people, you know, when you're speaking the local language, even after all these years, and they immediately answer you back
in English.
In English.
Yeah.
And it's just like, and with my son, he sees it. I'll like respond. I'll double down and go back and answer in Italian. And they'll be just as stubborn. And like, it's just this match, this grudge match. And usually eventually it's like, all right, fine, let's just speak English. But, no good. I mean, you know, I feel like it's at least for me, a lifetime journey, and I could still improve, and, you know, I'm still trying to improve, I've been here long enough to speak the language
What was the toughest adjustment and you know, culture shock, if there were. We hear a lot about, you know, I've talked to a lot of expats and also people looking to retire to Europe and things like that. And there's things that come up and they don't respect. And in Italy, it's usually has to come down to government red tape and bureaucracy and that kind of thing. And, you know, there is a culture shock and learning how to slow down and learning to appreciate different things. But was there a loneliness? Was there anything you missed or you're over it now?
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, you know, the obvious ones, and it's obvious because it is true. I mean, there are many things that kind of outside of Italy, whether it's the US or another country, just work more efficiently,
yeah.
You know? And so that, that can be frustrating. And depending on kind of where you're at with your immigration and everything, like if you're having to interact with the bureaucracy a lot, that can really wear you down. But if that's not part of your like day to day, not that it doesn't kind of appear in other places. To me, the biggest thing, I think, even though I've been here so long, is just what I love about coming back to the States is feeling like, you know, I don't need to, like we were just talking about the accent. So if someone hears my accent, immediately that provokes, oh, where are you from?
Yeah.
Not even in a judgmental way or anything. But it's nice to be back in the States and nobody's asking me where I'm from. I'm not like every conversation with someone new isn't, what are you doing here? And how long have you been here? And, you know, you could say, well, I need to work on my accent better, which is absolutely true. But, you know, for me and my experience, yeah, that's been kind of like, I mean, now I'm so used to it, but, you know, just that sense of like, I'm not from here. When I was traveling all those years, even when I stayed somewhere for 6 months or a year, it like that didn't matter as much as like here, where I was like, no, this is now my home. So I, you know, you want more of a sense of really like, I belong here, and people kind of recognize me as belonging here. And if you don't get that, that's something that you can miss. And at different times, I can say that's been my experience.
You know? Now, concerning your visa and stuff, is that because your wife is still employed there, you can stay, or did you have to apply for a different kind of work visa?
So
or something?
For the first like 9 years, I was here as her dependent. Then we actually split up. I had to kind of, when we got divorced, I had to figure out my own visa situation, unfortunately. But luckily, I mean, through my business and everything, I was able to secure my own, similar to a green card, permesso di soggiorno. And so, that's how I've managed to stay, all these years.
Well, do you see an increase in Americans inquiring about moving there, specifically in the last couple of years, maybe? Because it's blowing up. I know we talk about it a lot here, but, you know, Portugal's been found out. It's like really...
Yeah, with their golden...
Yeah, and they've already changing the rules. Italy just changed the rules. I interviewed a guy last month, my friend Ron, who had been trying for years... through his
I heard that
and they changed the rules at the 11th hour that he couldn't do it. You know, there's immigrants and immigration is a hot topic everywhere, but especially in Europe. Have you noticed it?
I certainly haven't noticed it, and kind of anecdotally I haven't really heard more people who've shared that with me. You know, Italy, you know, Portugal, I think nobody was talking about Portugal. They were very smart. They wanted to attract investment and people, and they opened up this visa right as like digital nomads were really kind of peaking. And it was this perfect synchronicity and all these people came. And then eventually, like a lot of things like that, they were like, all right, now, you know,
we achieved our goal. And nobody can afford a home now. None of the locals can afford to.
Then also all that with inflation. Italy, though, is different because, you know, unlike in the States where, you know, well, still to this day, but that might be changing. You know, if you're born in the US, you're a citizen. In Italy and a lot of European countries, it's by blood. So even if you've never been to Italy, if your great grandfather was, grandmother, or someone was in, you know, in your direct family line, was an Italian citizen, you can apply. So throughout the time I've been here, and I wouldn't say this has increased, you know, in the last few years, as you asked, I've known people who have come here and are going to the small town in Sicily to try and find the birth certificate or whatever documents they need for their great grandfather. And that's been like a constant, where Portugal I'd never heard of, then out of nowhere, I was like, every yeah. other person was moving to Portugal. Right. So Italy feels like it's just been a steady thing. Maybe the facts are different and it has increased, but not that I've personally kind of experienced.
What's the real story about going to these homes in these little rural towns, and they'll you can buy them for a dollar, but you got to fix them up?
I mean, yeah, you know, I think CNN has that like as a permanent story.
On yeah,
you know, like, and every time they make it seem like it's breaking news, but it's been, know. You know, it's funny. I've only heard like one story, and that it ended up being kind of like that Tom Hanks, Shelley Long movie, a total money.
Oh, pit. Yeah, the money pit. Yeah,
but. It was just one story. I mean, so I don't know. I mean, it certainly seems too good to be true.
Yeah. And they find out, yeah. and they find out, you know, things get built a lot slower than they're used right, to, yeah. than they may get yeah. used to here in the States.
Especially in those small towns.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, in Rome, because I've been through that. Like,
you rebuilt you know, an apartment or something?
An apartment that we, like renovated and, you know, I mean, it wasn't that slow, but, you know, based on maybe what you'd be expecting if you were coming from a big city in the U.S. But in those small towns, I can only imagine that it must go very, very
slow.
Oh,
my gosh. Yeah.
You know, and in one of these historic old homes where I think the problem is you might find you really have to kind of build the whole thing. And if that's the case, then, you know, the whole kind of commercial proposition is completely lost, because if you're right. having to spend all this money to, you know, what are you actually getting at that point?
Yeah.
You
know? So in your mind, what's a, I hear like the hot new place now in Italy is Puglia to go visit, the heel of the boot down there. Have you been? And is there a region that you'd like to promote that maybe needs a little love?
Right. So yeah, I have been to Puglia. That has increasingly become more and more popular. I mean, it used to be like everyone who came on the tour. So what else do you got planned? Yeah. Well, from here, we're going to Florence, then we're going to Venice.
Amalfi
then
Coast. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, and some Amalfi, some Cinque Terre.
Yeah.
And like, but Puglia, you know, it's still in the minority, but now I'm hearing it where I never used to. And it is beautiful and very worthwhile. And Italians have been going there in the summers, you know, in groves, for good reason. And I love the mountains, the Dolomiti, you know, the Italian Alps. It's just gorgeous. You've got the lakes up there. The food's great in that region. And, you know, it could be, you know, it's a winter paradise. That's generally when I've been. Snowboarding up there, and in the summer, especially as things keep getting hotter and hotter as the world heats up, you know, up there it's a great place to be in the summer with hiking and these little I don't know what it would be in English, but you know, like these huts where you can have a lunch on the mountain
yeah,
and
yeah.
just outside in the sun. And
ooh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And so that's great. There's a region called Marche, which is on the other side. And, you know, you've got the mountains and the coast. Not that that's so unique, but it's beautiful. And because it gets like very, very, very little foreign travelers, certainly North Americans, it's beautiful. I think it's... it's such a great place to go. And in going to a place where you don't have kind of the mass international tourism, especially coming from the States, you just get a different experience. You know, it's a different reception, you know, like, and you might go in the places where they don't really speak English. And that's kind of makes it a bit more authentic and adventurous. And not that you want every single place, probably, but to have some of that, which you would never have in the Amalfi Coast.
Right.
Or anywhere popular in Rome or Florence or Venice or, you know, so I would encourage it also for that reason, to just have like a different kind of travel experience.
Well, a couple more questions. I know it's late there. We got to wrap it up, but
I could be here all night.
The kids are sleeping. We have to, if you were going to say, if there was one city that you went to for eating Europe, that blew you away, that you didn't expect it, but it really surprised you, like that you didn't know you'd like it as much as you did.
Excellent question. I am going to say, because I'd never been before, is Porto in Portugal.
Oh, yeah.
Have you been?
Yes, I have. Yeah, a few years ago. It was great.
Would you agree? Right?
Oh, yeah.
The river, beautiful.
Very livable.
Yeah. It's got this, you know, it's, apparently it was a big inspiration for the Harry Potter books.
Yes.
She lived there for years. So you've got like that, which was totally unexpected because you think of, you know, Scotland and England. And then, you know, the food, the river, it's the history. Yeah, that really, really, that was a place that I was so delighted by and really impressed by.
Yeah. And finally, if you miss anything about America, I'm going to ask you what the thing is you miss the most. And I'll tell you, when I ask this to people who live abroad, after friends and family, which is always the number one answer, I'll tell you the second most after you tell me yours. What the thing is you, aside from friends and family, what do you miss?
Right. I think what I'm most excited about when I'm back is, I think kind of and this is coming from where I live, you know, in Rome. So the diversity of food, and this, you know, applies to like if I'm back in New York or LA or Chicago, like, and, you know, big cities or Philly, you know, what are we eating tonight? And it's like, you know, should we go for soup dumplings? Or I heard there's this new, you know, Malaysian place, which is amazing. So that's something, as well as, you know, Europe in general, or at least the Southern Europe, like breakfast, it's just not
a big deal.
So to go to like a diner or a coffee shop or a cute little kind of brunch spot and have an amazing breakfast and just have my coffee refilled and refilled as opposed to, you know, just a shot of espresso, which I love, but I miss.
Yeah.
Want me to top that up, warm that up? Yeah. I'm for like the 11th.
Refills. Why not? Yeah. Something called free refills. That's
exactly.
But the
even just refills.
Yeah,
is not
it refills
concept.
At all. But the but the answer, you're kind of on that track. The most popular answer I get after friends and family, Mexican food.
Oh right.
That's what.
Yeah. Mexican food hasn't really traveled well to Europe. I mean, even in Spain, like you would think, just with the kind of migration, but immigration, but. No, I mean, Mexican food.
It's hard to get
in the U.S. and in Mexico.
And I've made that mistake many times around the world when I'm jonesing and I was like, oh, there's a Mexican place here in, you know, Germany, and I'll go there and it's the worst I've ever had.
You just got to keep lowering your standards.
It's terrible.
And eventually it's like, this isn't that bad, you know.
And now after living
in the Mexican.
And for living in California, especially, I'm ruined. So I can't, you know. Can't order it.
All right, I'm going to change my answer.
Right. finally, cheesesteak recommendation. Favorite place in Philly?
All right. I mean, I've been saying for years, also because of nostalgia, Jim's Cheesesteaks on South Street.
Okay.
To me, is still number one. I mean, everyone talks about Angelo's now and
Gino's or whatever.
Well, Geno's and Pat's, they're like, but nobody generally nominates them as their favorite.
Sure.
But this place, Angelo's, is good. But to me, Jim's, they always show it on like Monday Night Football.
Okay.
It's phenomenal, and it'll always be number one in my heart.
Great. All right. Now you can get the plugs in. Where can people find you? Do you have a personal like Instagram account, or is it all through the business?
It's pretty much all through the business. I'm getting a little more active on LinkedIn, and I probably should be much more so. But Instagram, Facebook, I got off years ago, and Instagram, I have an account, and I think I have 2 followers. So that's probably not the spot to go. So yeah. We have an amazing Instagram account. We've got like 80,000 followers because we put out such great, fun content about all our cities, where to eat, what's happening, different, you know, today's coffee day or whatever it might be, you know, tips and tricks. So that's Eating Europe on Instagram and TikTok. EatingEurope.com on our website. We have a very active blog. As well, with tons of great resources and info, and then YouTube, you know, YouTube Shorts as well. So yeah, Eating Europe, you'll find us everywhere you find content. We're there.
All right, great. So we'll have links to all this too, as well at Travel Tales Podcast when the episode comes out. And finally, Kenny, what do you think all this experience traveling around the world and meeting people and doing all the things you've done, what has it taught you about the world? What has it taught you about people? And how has it changed you?
About people, it really kind of made me see, you know, when you're traveling around, when you're doing things like hitchhiking and going to places where you're a little vulnerable, so off the beaten path, you really see just how incredible and kind and welcoming and hospitable people are. But the caveat for that, and this was one of my big lessons, is you need to create space for that to happen. So like if you're just traveling for a week and you have a really tight itinerary and day one, we're doing this, and none of that kind of magical stuff or those really beautiful human encounters will happen. But if you go somewhere for weeks and say, you know, like, I don't even have a plan, I'm just going to wander around today, that's when you end up eating lobsters on the beach with some guys, you know, the next day. Yeah. So I think that's it. And then when you have that experience, you know, it makes you want to be just as kind and giving and hospitable to the travelers who cross your path wherever you live. So that's been kind of my lesson and what I've tried to take from it since I don't travel as much anymore.
Well, that's awesome. Well, thanks, Kenny. I appreciate you doing this. And thanks for staying up. Hopefully when I'm in Rome next, we can break bread together.
Absolutely. I would love that.
We go to the market. Thank you, Michael. No, thank you. Kenny Dunn, everybody.
Sure. For spontaneous travelers, Winging It is the perfect listen. James Hammond shares stories and tips from 75-plus countries. Find it at voyescape.com.